Okay, we're going to take your phone calls now this final hour with J. Richard Gott as we talk about his work sizing up the universe, time travel, and Einstein's universe. And your calls are next on Coast to Coast AM. J., do you think the universe could be alive? Alive is the way we think alive should be.
Well, we're here. We're the life in the universe. We're the most interesting part, I think.
I think so, too. But I think, you know, it is. You know, I believe this planet is alive. I mean, there's just got to be something to it. But you were talking about the intelligence behind this universe before we got to the top of the hour.
Well, I was saying that we were trying to make the universe be its own mother in this idea that you might have a little time loop at the beginning. And if photons were able to go back into the past, they would go down all these branches, end up at the beginning time loop, go around it an infinite number of times, and have an infinite buildup of energy and destroy the time loop. And that's not a self-consistent solution. It'd be like killing your grandmother. So the only self-consistent solution, if you have a little time loop at the beginning of the universe, is that photons have to go out the branch away from the time loop. And so it explains this arrow of time that we actually observe. So we think that's interesting evidence that might be in favor of a little time loop at the beginning of the universe, which might make the universe be able to be its own mother. Time travel does some interesting things in terms of first cause that might make it interesting for the beginning of the universe. And that's one of the interesting reasons we're interested in studying it, is because it might give some clues as to how the universe even got started.
All right, let's go to some of the calls here. Elaine in Fort Myers, Florida, east of the Rockies. Hey, good morning, Elaine.
Hi, good morning, George. Hi, good morning. Now it gets to George, where I've heard you say before, where you start hammering your own head and saying, "Ah, oh, like, you know, it's like I can't figure this out," you know.
<That's right.
laughs> But I watched a show on PBS a couple of years ago about fractals, which you were talking about, and that fascinates me so much because I keep picturing this display they had on the PBS show about the branches where one goes off and then a duplicate comes out and it just keeps going. That's the closest thing that I can, in my human understanding, understand infinity, of where it just never ends. There's another branch and then another branch off another branch and three or more branches. This keeps going into infinity and infinity, but still then it gets back to of where the original thing come from, which was where our mind just can't comprehend. But I'm very interested in fractals. And I'd just like to have a little more elaboration on that.
All right, sure thing.
I think that this is the one of the most popular pictures for the structure of the universe. It's a fractal tree. It's each branch, as you say, grows off the previous branches. And usually when you see a fractal like this, the branches get smaller and smaller and tinier, little twigs and things. But in this case, the little twigs actually have time to grow up and be as big as the trunk themselves. There's an infinite amount of space there, so to speak. So the only thing that's real is the tree itself. So it can continue to grow branches, and these branches can grow up to be inflate to be as big as the trunk and grow branches of their own. So this is one of the implications, it seems, of inflation. You may get different universes there that even have different laws of physics. So they'll have a different ratio of the mass of the proton and the electron. So you could have some very bizarre universes out there. Some branches may not all be alike. And we're living in one of these branches. And we tried to use this branching phenomena, maybe, as to explain maybe how the trunk got there. And as I said, other people say, well, maybe the trunk just sprung into existence. So these are the different ideas that people have for trying to explain the trunk. But we know that our universe is an expanding branch, if you will, and so we think that there could be other branches as well, making a multiverse.
What do you think could be the next major discoveries out there, Richard? You know, like they're talking about more and more black holes. What do you think it could be?
Well, we're looking for habitable planets that are in the habitable zone of their star. And we're going to have a new satellite here, Kepler, which is going to measure transits in front of the planets passing in front of their stars. So you can see their silhouette as they pass in front of the star. And this is going to discover a lot of planets, maybe some Earth-like planets. And finding an Earth-like planet is a big thing people are looking for. In terms of the early universe, we'd really like to have string theory come of age and make some predictions that might explain to us how the universe got started, able to explain some of the things. We're looking for this particle called the Higgs particle at the supercollider in Europe, and that's a particle that gave other particles its mass. If we discover this particle, this will be a very big development and will help us to explain a lot of particle physics. And so that's quite exciting and perhaps in the near future. So I think we're at an exciting epoch.
All right. Next up, we go to Algonac, Michigan. Thomas is there. First time caller. Hey, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
My question is, I learned on a documentary by Stephen Hawking that we have quantum wormholes in matter, in general matter. Now, I know there's limited understanding of what the consciousness does, and we cannot physically fit into these quantum wormholes, but could consciousness fit through these wormholes? Now, take the answer off the air.
Well, what was that again?
I don't know if it's a question, but he was talking about wormholes.
Yes. There are, we believe, microscopic wormholes, about 10 to the minus 33 centimeters across. Wormholes, to prop them open, need some negative energy stuff. And curiously, there's a quantum effect called the Casimir effect, which says that if you take two metal plates and you hold them very close to each other, the vacuum, the empty space in between the plates, acquires a negative energy density. And so Kip Thorne is using parallel plates in the centers of his wormholes to hold them open. And so the idea, if you're trying to make a time machine out of a wormhole, is to somehow enlarge these microscopic wormholes that Stephen Hawking was talking about and make them large enough for someone to pass through. And they would have to be made really quite large, maybe a couple of hundred million solar masses. But there's an intriguing possibility there that you might be able to mine microscopic wormholes and somehow enlarge them and make them into one that would be useful.
All right, let's go to Miami, Florida, and Bob's there on Coast to Coast. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
How you doing, George? How you doing, Richard?
Great.
My question is this. You said that your Great Wall is 1.3 billion light years long, right?
Right.
Okay, and you said that the universe is 13.7 billion years old. Does that mean that your Great Wall is like one-tenth the size of the universe?
Yeah, it's one-tenth the radius of the universe. In fact, in our book, we have a picture, really for the first time, of the entire visible universe using real data, showing the extent of the visible universe. You can see about 130,000 galaxies and quasars in this picture from the Sloan survey, which was done at Princeton, started at Princeton. And around the edge is the cosmic microwave background, which has been observed by the WMAP satellite. And so we have a colored circumference of this showing the actual data from the WMAP satellite. So you can see the region we can see is centered on ourselves. Like if you go to the top of the Empire State Building in New York City, you see out to the horizon, you see an area of New York that includes part of New Jersey and Connecticut and so forth. That area is centered on the Empire State Building. If you were observing from the top of the Sears Tower in Chicago, you'd see a completely different region. So this region that we can see is centered on us just because we can see everything that's within a radius of 13.7 billion light years because of the finite speed of light. Doesn't mean we're at the center of the universe, but there's this wonderful picture that we have now where you can actually see a map of the entire visible universe on one page.
All right, we go to now West Hartford, Connecticut. It's Bill on Coast to Coast. Bill, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yes, hi. Hi, Richard. Hi, this is Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I know space and astronomy, so I know what you're talking about. I'm sure you're aware of your colleagues, Dr. Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok's cyclical model of the universe, which involves the multiverse theories. It's called the ekpyriotic universe, and in their theories, they say that each universe of the potential infinite universes are like three-dimensional membranes, or they call them brains, in four-dimensional hyperspace. And every trillion years or so, a brain bangs into another brain, and that's, in effect, what a Big Bang is. And the Big Bang that happened in our universe 13.7 billion years ago was simply another brain hitting our brain, of which our universe is in, or our membrane, of which our universe is in. My question to you specifically is, do you think the latest spacecraft that has been in space for a year and a half now observing the Big Bang, known as Planck, which is even far more better, more sophisticated, and more high definition than the one you mentioned a few minutes ago, WMAP, right, do you think that when Planck comes out with its all-sky data early next year, 2011, or possibly it'll be refined by 2012, will it give the first high-quality scientific data indicating the existence of multiple universes? In other words, will it prove that there is a multiverse, and that will also prove that there was no real beginning to our universe and no real end, meaning there were universes before ours, obviously, if this is true, and universes after ours, which shows that the Bible is wrong when it says, in the beginning, God, because there's no real beginning and no real end to the universes?
Well, the we discuss this this in the new book, The Sizing Up the Universe. We talk about this cyclic model that Steinhardt and Turok have, and it's one of the possibilities. And as I say, we're exploring a variety of different possibilities. We don't know which one is true. That theory is testable against the standard inflationary theory. They assume there's an inflationary epoch before that's occurring at rather low intensity inflation, like we're observing in the universe today, an accelerated expansion due to what we call dark energy. So the cyclic model is testable against the standard inflationary model because we're looking for tensor modes, gravity wave modes in the microwave background, and these can be seen, and Planck potentially can measure whether they're there. If they find them there, it would prove inflation is correct and the ekpyriotic model is wrong. If we don't find them there, there's still inflationary models that could produce that. So below the detectable limit that we have. But it's a very good test between these two theories, and I think people are looking forward excitedly to see whether in the future, by making polarization measurements and making more accurate measurements of the microwave background, we can test between this ekpyriotic theory and the other one, the standard inflationary theory. In some pictures of inflation, the universe extends infinitely into the past. Other ones, though, have a finite beginning. The Stephen Hawking picture and a Vilenkin picture, there's a trunk. There's an earliest inflating epoch, and this pops into existence. Or in our case, there's a little time loop at the beginning. So the ekpyrotic model you mentioned is cyclic, and so it continues to go on back in the past. So there are both models that are being seriously considered today that have a definite beginning. In fact, one of the arguments that people make occasionally is they say, well, time was created in the beginning as well as space, so there's no before that event. It's like at the South Pole. There's nothing south of the South Pole. There's nothing before this beginning point because time didn't exist then. So there are both points of view out there that the universe might have had a finite beginning, an earliest thing that might have been a time loop, in which case there's no earliest event. It's like the Earth is finite toward the east, but you can keep going east and eventually you'll come back to where you started. So if there's a little time loop at the beginning, you keep going back and then you get to the time loop and then you just keep going around and around the time loop. So there was a beginning, but yet no earliest event. So these are the different possibilities that we discuss in the Sizing Up the Universe book, and time will tell which one of these gets verified by observations. And as you point out, the Planck satellite provides a very important test coming up in the near future.
Let me ask you this too, Jay. The moon is where it is. If it wasn't where it is, what would happen to us on the planet?
Well, the moon is, if the moon were like further away or less massive, we would have less, it would have less tidal influence on us. This would be not so good for us because the moon helps to stabilize the axis of rotation of the Earth and give us seasons that don't vary. Mars doesn't have such a big moon as two small, tiny moons. And so the axis of rotation has wandered in Mars over a long periods of time, giving more variety to the climate, which is not necessarily a good thing. The moon may have had an influence in the terms of the tides in producing tidal pools, which helped to get amphibians out onto the land. Something gets stranded out in a tidal pool and ends up on the land. And so the moon may have had an influence in that effect. So in general, people think that the moon was helpful to us.
Well, maybe so. Richard, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a second. We're going to take final phone calls with you. Fascinating discussion tonight with the astrophysicist J. Richard Gott III, who happens to be a professor of the fine university, Princeton University. So we'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, Bill Burns joins us, my co-author with the book Worker in the Light and Journey in the Light, Journey to the Light. But we're going to be talking with Bill about aliens in America. It's his UFO Hunter's Guide. So we'll be back with Bill in a moment on Coast to Coast AM tomorrow. When we come back, we'll take final phone calls with J. Richard Gott. Don't go away. And welcome back to Coast, J. Richard Gott with us. J. Richard, do you go on speaking engagements? Do you travel much?
Sure.
And do they love you? What do you talk about?
Well, all these sorts of things. I think people really have a great interest in all these topics.
Yeah, they do.
How wonderful the universe is, how interesting it is, how it might have gotten here, what about particle physics, what does it tell us, what about time travel. These are fantastic things that were often in the realm of science fiction but have now come into being part of science.
It would not surprise you if a time machine would get developed in the next 50 years, or would it?
Well, it's I'll tell you what we could do. People always ask me, well, what could we really do in the next 50 years, you know? We could do in the next 50 years the following thing. We could make time travel to the future a 1,000 times longer trip than we've done so far. All you'd have to do is put an astronaut on the planet Mercury, and we could do that with our current technology, and let them live there for 30 years and then come back. Now, Mercury is close into the sun, deep in the gravitational well of the sun. So clocks tick slowly because they're deep in the gravitational well of the sun. Einstein said that. And also Mercury's going around the sun very fast. So because of special relativity, clocks tick slowly there. When that astronaut came back, they would be 22 seconds to the future of where they would expect to be. Now, again, this is a small amount. But remember, we've gone 1/48 of a second toward the future. That's an increase by a factor of 1,000 that we could do within the next 50 years. Keep going like that.
You don't think the body would age at all? Don't we go to with our own clock inside?
Well, this is the interesting thing. Einstein had the hypothesis that motion was relative and that the speed of light was always a constant. And if an astronaut flew by you at a high speed and he had a light clock where it bounced back and forth between two mirrors, up and down, up and down, up and down, as you saw that light clock go by, you would see it go diagonally, that light beam go diagonally, bouncing back and forth between the moving mirrors. And that diagonal path is longer. And so if it's true that you always saw the speed of light as 186,000 miles per second, as he hypothesized, then that light clock would have to tick slowly, according to you. And then the astronaut would also have to age more slowly. All his biological processes would have to age more slowly. Otherwise, the astronaut could tell he was moving, violating the other postulate, which was that motion is relative and the astronaut can't tell that he's moving. That means that all the aging processes have to go slower by the same factor as the light clock. Now, those two hypotheses sound strange, and they have strange results. But he proved other theorems from this as well, that E equals mc squared. This is one of the theorems that he proved. And the atomic bomb works. It blows up and turns in a small amount of mass into an enormous amount of energy. So because we believe, we observe the theorems that Einstein proved off those hypotheses, we believe those hypotheses. And as I told you, we actually check that atomic clocks tick slowly as they're moving, just like he said. So the aging process is, like you say, even though they're complex biological processes, they have to go more slowly too.
All right, let's go to Bellingham, Washington. It's Ray's turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, Ray, go ahead.
Hey, guys. Man, I love your program. I've spoke on your show before.
Super.
I really hate to say this, but your time theory travel is a ultimate paradox. But also, if our universe is a grain of sand, now what lies beyond what we cannot see? See, the universe is eternal. There is no end, there's no beginning. What lies beyond what we cannot detect? And thank you, I'll take my answer off the air.
That has always been part of the paradox, Jay. What lies beyond what we can't detect?
Well, inflation tells us that there are universes beyond our own that we will never see. That we can see out a certain point, but the universe is the multiverse is expanding so fast.
Are they hooked to us like bubbles?
Yes. It's sort of like bubbles. There can be bubble universes. I worked on a theory of bubble universes. these bubbles can be expanding, and the sea itself is expanding still faster, so the bubbles don't collide with each other, and so the bubbles never percolate, and you have an ever-expanding sea with bubbles being formed. And even though the bubble wall may be expanding at near the speed of light, it doesn't eat up the whole multiverse, because that sea of inflating universe is expanding even faster. So it's like a stretching rubber sheet. It can stretch faster than the speed of light can cross it. And so there are regions that we can never see. And so we do have the idea that our universe is like a tiny speck, one of an infinite number of universes in an ever-expanding sea. And we can't see them directly, but we can test the theory that produced them, and it seems that inflation, which predicts all these things, is explaining to us what we can see in the cosmic microwave background. So that's why we take these things seriously.
Okay, next up we go to Marshall in Centerville, Ohio. Thanks for holding, Marshall. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thank you.
Good. Dr. Gott, I always wanted to talk to you about this particular idea of yours about the self-creating universe. There's a problem with it, and the problem is before your branch goes back and back in time to create the beginning of the universe, it had to be again in the first place. The easy way to prove that is imagine being at that point before the curvature back in time again, and you have a video camera. You can then show that, hey, well, wait a minute, we've got a video here showing that this curvature hasn't happened yet. So in a sense, the universe creates itself from the very beginning. There is no need for this curvature back in time. Besides, the geometry of that curvature might cause certain kinds of implications that you haven't considered as far as your model is concerned. I was wondering what you had to say about that.
Well, our model is the standard inflating cosmology. It has a time loop in it, so that if you're sitting in this loop, there's events that come before you. And so if you're let's say you're in the trunk, and you ask what happened earlier, you go back in time earlier and earlier and earlier, then you go around this loop and come in the branch. That's in your future, and then it comes back and connects with you. So it's like the geometry of this is like a loop in the numeral six. And we know that solutions like this are possible in general relativity. So we're just applying this to the beginning of the universe. So it's all self-consistent. There's every event has an event that precedes it, but you keep going around the loop, and there is no earliest event, but yet the universe has a beginning, which is the loop itself. So it's a little time machine at the beginning of the universe that shuts down. If you wait, you can imagine you're a time traveler, you might circulate around this loop once, come back to where you were, but then if you went out the top of that numeral six, the time machine disappears. So you then go out the branches, and you're out into an infinite fractal universe of branches. So we're just trying a different way to get the trunk started, and we were able to solve the quantum mechanics of this, and we found that the solution was stable, and that this solution was self-consistent quantum solution. And so it looks like a workable solution for the beginning of the universe that would make the universe its own mother and explain how it got started.
If, you know, when we were talking about the planet and leaving the planet, going to Mars, would these astronauts who would volunteer for this incredible mission of never coming back, there's no need to even pay them, is there?
That's true, yes.
We get it done for free.
That's,
unless
that's
maybe they
true.
Have family.
The space colonists basically work for you for free because
exactly.
they're expanding their colony. They're their job, so to speak, when they get on Mars is to have children and expand the colony by a factor of two and using indigenous materials. And there's enough time to do this, and we're using all materials from Mars. So colonies are a great bargain from our point of view. If we can just get one started, it could lead to a whole civilization on Mars. So it's something we ought to be doing. And an interesting thing that I comment on in the Sizing Up the Universe is that in the year 2084, which is a long time from now, mm-hmm. Mars will be sitting at such a location so that the Earth and the Moon will transit in front of the Sun. And so if you're sitting on Mars in 2084, you'll be able to see the Earth and the Moon transit in front of the Sun. You can see their silhouettes as they pass across the front of the Sun. And the big question is, in my mind, will there be anyone there to see it?
Yeah,
there
right.
should be, but will we be smart enough to do this?
And will there be anybody on Earth to look back at them, right?
Well, that's true, too. I think there'll be people on Earth. We've been around a long time, so I think there'll be people still on Earth in 2084. But the space program's only been around for 50 years, so we have to worry that the real space race is whether we get off the planet onto Mars and then on to other places. I mean, once we're on Mars, you know, it might double our chance of ever going to Alpha Centauri, because it might be the folks on Mars that did it as likely as the people on the Earth 1,000 years from now or something. So the big question is, do we get off the Earth before the money for the space program may run out?
Exactly. Let's go to San Antonio, Texas. It's Ralph's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Ralph.
How you doing, Mr. Norrie?
Well, thank you.
How about you, Mr. J?
Fine.
Yeah, this isn't my first time calling. I've called numerous times, but long-time listener. Yeah, my question for you, Mr. J, is what's your take on the whole deja vu phenomena as far as in relation to what y'all are talking about? I mean, you know, deja vu is where, like, you say you're standing somewhere and all of a sudden, you get this feeling, oh, I've been here before, I've seen this happen before, or something like that. Could that have something to do with, like, I don't know, parallel dimensions, universe? Or, I don't know, if I'm using the right terminology, I'm trying to explain it as best as I can. Or, you understand what I mean?
Yes, there's a phenomena in time travel, where there's a djinn particle that goes around. It has a circular world line through space-time. And Alan Lightman talked about you could have a djinn person who had a world line that was a circle in an appropriate time machine. And it would seem to them like they were immortal, but they would only have maybe a year to live if that loop had a circumference of a year. So they keep reliving the same year over and over again. And Alan Lightman said, well, there were two possibilities. Either those djinn people in the time machine would have deja vu or not. If they had deja vu, they'd always be saying, I'm eating breakfast here with the scrambled eggs. I've done this before. And they would correctly remember that they'd had that same breakfast before. But then there might be other ones that just didn't remember and everything seemed new to them. And they were surprised by everything that happened. So in time travel, you can definitely have deja vu experience, and particularly if, let's say, you go back and visit your earlier self, you will remember the conversation that you had, and if it's all one self-consistent thing and one four-dimensional picture, then you'll find yourself saying exactly the same thing that you heard yourself say earlier, so you'd have a big feeling of deja vu and some time travel situation.
Let's go next, if we can get you in, to Thomas in Plano, Texas. Go ahead, Thomas.
Hey, guys, man, this is great stuff, really great stuff.
It really is, yeah.
But now my question is about constants. I mean, we say, you know, the speed of light is a constant, what, gravity is a constant, time's a constant. We have all these constants, but are they truly constants?
Well, we try to measure this. We've measured whether gravity is constant. Some people thought gravity might be weakening in time. And the best test of that seems to be spinning neutron stars. And if gravity were weakening, their spin would change with time. And we don't observe that in some very particular cases. And so it seems like gravity is not weakening. Gravity is weak, and therefore the sun takes a long time to burn out. And that's why we're living so many billions of years. We're living such a long time after the Big Bang. Gravity is weak, and that allows us to see a strong distance, a long distance. So the fact that the force of gravity happens to look like a constant and be weak allows us to get the remarkable view of the universe that we actually see. As far as we know, that constant isn't changing, but in the very early universe, the constants may change, and that's an interesting area of speculation.
We've got just about a minute left. We're running out of time, Richard. I want to thank you for being on the show, and it's just always fun to talk with you, my friend. Good
well,
luck.
Well, thanks a lot. I've enjoyed it. It's been terrific.
Sizing Up the Universe, Time Travel, and Einstein's Universe, both his websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, his measurement of the Sloan Great Wall of Galaxies entered into the Guinness World Records in 2006 as the largest structure in the universe. It's one-tenth the size of the universe. How about that? Don't forget, Bill Burns joins me on our next program as we talk about aliens in America. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.